From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Alice MacDermott's novels are starkly beautiful, quietly devastating portraits of Irish-American families in the 20th and early 21st centuries. In her National Book Award-winning Charming Billy, she brilliantly recast the charming Irish drunk as a real, complex man. She takes the vivid particularities of Irish-American life and shows us universal experience. This hour on Point, the great Alice MacDermott on the Irish-American path and the American immigrant challenge. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What experience do all immigrants share? What's unique in the Irish-American experience? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And yes, our conversation comes on St. Patrick's Day. Here's pipers and drummers marching through downtown Atlanta, Georgia, yesterday in that city's St. Patrick's Day parade. Joining me now from Washington, and we've got the bagpipes, Alice, to march you in, is Alice MacDermott, author of 7 critically acclaimed novels. Her 1998 novel, Charming Billy, won the National Book Award. Her most recent is Someone, which came out last fall to much praise. Alice MacDermott, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
So great to have you. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst and author, indisputably Irish-American, Jack Beatty. Jack, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Alice.
And, hello, Jack.
And happy St. Patrick's Day to all. And what an interesting one. Can we just go to the news of this particular holiday and the parades yesterday? This was in New York and in Boston. Mayors, one Italian-American, one Irish-American, refusing to join the parades because gay participants were not allowed to openly march in those parades. Alice, are you surprised that we're still having this conversation in 2014, or is it somehow baked in the soda bread?
Well, argument is one of our pastimes in the Irish-American community and the Irish community. So if we can have a good fight over anything at all, we'd probably prefer that to peace.
Jack, what do you think? Are you amazed that it came so close? I mean, up to the last minute, the mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh, it seemed as though he might be there and might be the gay participation. And then at the end, it all fell apart.
Yeah, you know, it's like watching, what's the phrase, dead man walking. I mean, in 5 years, no one will remember this. I mean, this is some sort of holdout, some kind of rear guard action against the flow of history. Everybody knows it. Everybody sees it. It's written in the numbers, in the demography, in what young people think, Irish Americans and others. It just takes for this older generation to move on.
I've got a little tape of the mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh, just recently taken office here, talking about why it didn't happen, why he wasn't there after members of the LGBT community were not allowed to march. Here he is on Saturday before parade day.
One person wouldn't budge on a banner, so I'm not marching in the parade if people can't express who they are.
But there was also tradition all over the place, including in Boston, South Boston, big breakfast on the day before St. Patrick's Day. And this year, you had there the African-American governor of Massachusetts and a Haitian-American, Massachusetts Senator Linda Dorsina-Forey. Here was the governor talking to the assembled crowd, mainly Irish, but we've got all new colors in America, about their names, Patrick and Forey, and what they were seeing on this day before St. Patrick's Day.
Have a good look, everybody. This is what a Forey and a Patrick looks like these days.
And here was the Massachusetts Senator Linda Dorsina-Forey, Haitian-American, joking to folks watching on TV, watching at home.
And for those of you watching at home, do not adjust your television set. There is nothing wrong with the picture on your TV.
Jack Beatty, there's a Patrick and a Forey for you these days. There's change, too.
Yes, and Senator Forey's next line was, there's nothing wrong with your TV. Pause. Yes, I'm a woman.
Right. Enough said, and yet it said volumes. Alice MacDermott, I don't think you set out to write about Irish Americans in particular, but you ended up there. What in your wonderful path as a writer took you ultimately to that culture, that experience?
Well, it's material at hand. My parents were both first generation, born in New York, grandparents, all immigrants. So it was something I knew. I knew the turn of phrase. I knew their habits. I knew the way they look at the world. But I wasn't interested in particular to get that down. I think most of us who write fiction didn't go the journalism route because we're looking for those things that are true of us all. And in many ways, the details is just a means to an end.
And the accolade you're given, Alice, that is that in cultivating that the story of the Irish-American community, you managed to get to that universality. Do you find that easier or more difficult on the Irish-American cultural path to get that universal note?
Well, you know, the challenge and the fun of it is that there are so many accepted Irish-American cliches. So if you can start with the cliche, and rather than taking the easy route and in some way upending the stereotype and saying, oh, that lovable Irish drunken uncle of yours, he was really a pedophile, he was really an awful person, to turn that around and say that lovable Irish drunken uncle of yours was indeed lovable and a drunk at the same time. And although he fit every cliche that the community can throw at you, he was also unique. One of a kind, and that's the challenge as a fiction writer, to take that cliche and look at it again and look at it again until it's demolished, and we only have the experience of the individual.
Jack, if you can get by immigrant stereotypes, and we've laid them on everyone, if you can get by Irish American immigrant stereotypes, I suppose you're well on your way to universal experience. Those are potent and long-lasting. Alice did it in Charming Billy in a big way.
She did. It's a wonderful novel. I remember it. My emotions remember it. It was so moving and surprising. There are big surprises in it. But, you know, I read a couple of years ago a study of Italian Americans that pointed out how many are involved in organized crime. Well, according to the study, it was a scintilla of 1%. I mean, vanishing percentage. And yet, what's the stereotype?
The Godfather, Tony Soprano.
And similarly with the Irish and the drinker, and you know, people get this idea from people like Alice and you know, Eugene O'Neill and so on. I wonder, Alice, what you think about that? Are you, you know, putting our dirty laundry out there and trading on these stereotypes? Are you afraid you're giving the goyim a little ammunition? What do you say?
I think one thing that maybe is not as common a stereotype about the Irish, but is certainly, in my experience, a defining characteristic, and that is we don't put up with inauthenticity much. Be real is a refrain, of the Irish-American community. So perhaps we have a tendency to both admit our sins and be offended by the stereotype based on our sins. I was just at a dinner party in New York not too long ago when we were having a discussion about the great Seamus Heaney. And a professor at the table turned to me and said, "Do you mind if I tell an Irish joke?" And I hesitantly said, please go ahead. And he told the one about what's the difference between an Irish wake and an Irish wedding, one less drunk. yes, and this was in polite company. But being Irish-American, I was polite about it, and I laughed and said, yes, indeed, I had heard that before. And I thought about how many other hyphenated Americans would not tolerate that kind of joke or would not be told that kind of joke. And yet, not 20 minutes later, I was having a conversation with someone else at the table, and I realized what we were talking about was a mutual friend, another writer, who hadn't made it to the evening because he was struggling with alcoholism. That's a reality.
Jack, Alice McDermott puts Charming Billy out there, and the whiskey's right there as well, but then there's plenty of truth and insight about human complexity there.
Oh, yes, yes. And it comes through in her a sort of sweet, sad music. I mean, you just... I think the melancholy is a trap for the Irish. And you go there, and then you come right back. I mean, you keep it light and yet sad at the same time. That's quite a gift.
I suppose that's the yo-yo. That's just that's the trip we're all on. Why a trap of the Irish, Jack?
Well, because it leads to self-pity. It leads to the maudlin. It sort of warrants drink. Well, by gosh, I've got to console myself for all these sorrows. And it plays right into the Irish self-dramatization. And, you know, a pinprick becomes a woe and all the rest. So I think there's a rancidness in Irish nostalgia, I think at least. And also something decent in it, a way to hold on to fading memories of the old country. So hard to judge it once and for all.
Jack Beattie, it's so great to have you here on St. Patrick's Day. And Alice McDermott, it's most certainly great to have you with us here. Author of Someone and Charming Billy and so many more great novels. Molly Bloom here from Norman Blake and Tony Rice. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Sound there from New York's St. Patrick's Day parade yesterday. Controversy there around gay groups that would or would not be allowed to march. And the mayor of New York, as with the mayor of Boston, not showing up in the event because of how it all turned out. We're talking today about Irish America, the immigrant experience and beyond with acclaimed novelist Alice McDermott, author of Charming Billy, Someone last year, and so many more. Just terrific. She's with us today from Washington, D.C. Jack Beattie is here as well. Son of the soil, the sod. We also had in Washington, where you are, Alice, and in Boston, we had the Irish Prime Minister, Enda Kenny. Here he was with President Obama and Vice President Biden, Irish-American, at the White House St. Patrick's Day reception. The Irish Prime Minister describing Ireland's relationship with, or the relationship of the Irish, with their past and their future.
So, Mr. President, these are excavations, not just of our history, but of life on our island, the geology of our heart, and they signal our tradition and our capacity to endure and to adapt, to survive and to thrive, to know fear, to know loss, and yet to conscript new generations to courage and vision and a brilliant future across the millennia.
Oh, high talk there from the Irish Prime Minister at the White House. Alice, Jack, callers, lots of callers for both of you. Ray in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. Ray, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. It is wonderful to have the guest on, and she is well-renowned about Irish, et cetera, history and all that. Thank you for being on. It's an honor to talk with you. Okay, I'm going to start off with I was born and raised north in the northwestern part of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, outside in Milwaukee and in the country. Anyways, to make a long story short, I was brought up in an Irish community around Holy Hill, Wisconsin, by Hartford. And we didn't have the stigmas attached to a lot of the portrayals of Irish being drunk and blah, blah, this and that. It was mostly merry. They were merry people. We were culturally orientated as far as extended family. I was born and raised at the end of the polio epidemic, and there was a lot of things going on with that. People were celebrating life and death. It's just the whole extended community around there, the rolling hills that looks just like Ireland. It was a very positive experience, and the Irish in that community were well respected. And also there was German immigrants and a variety of other people. We all worked kind of hand in hand to bridge the gap between differences and things. It just was a wonderful experience, and I'm very proud to be part Irish, and especially with all this. And thank you for everything, and I have to get rolling. I have an appointment. Okay. I just wanted to make this positive comment about the Irish. You all have
thank
a good
you.
Day.
Thank
duly
you.
Noted. Thank you, Ray and Rhinelander. A little bit of Irish heaven there in those rolling hills outside Milwaukee. But of course, as you write, Alice, I mean, there's plenty that's wonderful, and there's plenty that's just as complex and tragic as all human life in this community. But you hear Ray's holding on to that. This was heaven.
Yes, well, you know, there's great beauty, not only in Ireland itself, but in the Irish culture, especially when it comes to language. If we can claim one perhaps benefit in being Irish, that is, we love a sentence. I think listening to the Taoiseach speaking at the White House, you understood that. Mm-hmm. It maybe wasn't the language we were meant to be speaking, but it's the language that we made our own. And just the beauty of the way the Irish are able to make a sentence mean a number of things, and so much that's not said is as lovely as what's said.
Jack Beattie, you've been a writer most of your life. In that, have you felt a cultural gift in being Irish-American? Did you embrace it? Did you resist it and look for a different pattern? How do you think about it?
Well, I think in writers, it can be a temptation toward purple prose, you know, toward overdoing it. And I think that's part of what I'm aware of. But also, you know, a sense of, by gosh, you are in a tradition. You know, when you see there's a history of British literature, one of the volumes is called Eight British Writers. Well, British, about three quarters of them are Irish. Mm. You know, from Shaw to Yeats to Joyce, and so it's a proud heritage, I think, people have. And you know, if language, then the other one is humor. And Bill Shannon, William Shannon, who was President Carter's ambassador to Ireland and a wonderful writer, in his book, The American Irish, speaks to the paradox, the doubleness of humor among the Irish. He says, it's a strange gift, this national capacity for satire. Too often, it is signified a fatal lack of self-confidence that leads to settling for something less than the highest success. Supreme egotism and utter seriousness are necessary for the greatest accomplishment, and these the Irish find hard to sustain. At some point, the instinct to see life in a comic light becomes irresistible, and ambition falls before it.
Alice, that's a beautiful and difficult. Alice, what about humor, Irish and humor in your world, the satire and the, well, there's another pitfall potentially.
Well, you know, I take a little bit of exception to that. I'm not sure that it's ambition that falls before it. Again, I think it's that sense that that the Irish have of the authentic. And I don't think it can separate the conversation about Irish Americans from Catholicism. And that sense of the shadow of mortality falling over everything we do. And that may be the thing that makes us look less ambitious than others, because we are so aware of the brevity of life and the brevity of our concerns, and how short-lived most of our passions will be inevitably.
You're attributing that to the sort of teachings of the church?
Sure.
The eye on the far shore? What about the sufferings of famine and all the rest?
I think both those things. But as I say, I don't think you can really separate. Even when you talk about the Irish and their use of language, you know, there's that sense of ritual and repetition, which is poetry, but is also what they're getting from the Mass, from their experience in church. And then there's that marvelous aspect of the Irish ability to believe fully in things unseen. That goes back to our pagan days, but the church made very good use of that.
Jack, what do you think? This sharp eye for inauthenticity, well, it can lead to truth. It can also lead to cutting things down to size or to satire.
Absolutely. And of course, one of the stock figures in Irish American literature is the wife who does just that. I mean, that's her speciality. The husband goes on about his dreams and the wife deflates him. I mean, that is part of the Maggie and Jigs aspect of Irish America. What do you think, Alice?
Well, there is that refrain. I know certainly from my own upbringing and from my extended experience with Irish Americans, and that's don't be getting ahead of yourself. And yes. And who do you think you are? What right. makes you think you're any better than anyone else? And, you know, I have to confess that having raised three millennials, I hear myself on occasion saying that to my own children.
Who do you think you are?
Who do you think you are? What makes you any better than anyone else?
Mark in West Roxbury, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I guess I grew up on the South Shore of Massachusetts, which and my family is from Dorchester and Milton. But as a kid, my parents never talked about their Irish heritage. And my grandparents all died a long time ago. And it's only now, as I'm in my 40s and my dad's in his 70s, that he starts to talk about it. And I wonder how many other people of my generation, you know, like Gen X, that kind of thing, have experienced that same thing, this sort of denial of heritage and a feeling of isolation as a result of it.
It's interesting, Mark. I'm so glad you raised it. Alice, I found myself thinking about this. I mean, I've seen you quoted I think it was your grandmother saying how grateful she was your mother, who was grateful that your mother moved to Brooklyn after she went back to Ireland.
Exactly.
And the grandmother who really didn't care to talk about Ireland. And now Mark's describing a younger generation maybe removed from it. You know, did we see all immigrants have immigration waves, have cycles? Did we see maybe in the 20th century the height of Irish-American, cultural nostalgia?
Yeah, I mean, my grandmother said of Ireland, if it was worth talking about, I wouldn't have left. And that ended the conversation there. My parents, both being first generation, saw themselves as Americans and had no patience for what they called the stage Irish, the people who were more Irish than the Irish. That was over and done with, and they were Americans. And as I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, every grandparent I knew had an accent. As a matter of fact, I thought you had to have an accent in order to be a grandparent.
Not necessarily Irish in your
but
case.
But not necessarily Irish, Italian, right, Polish, right, Russian. Right. So the sense of being very... Now, my father did tell us growing up that being Irish was the best thing to be, but you didn't want to brag about that, so it was better not to talk about it because you'd make all the other people feel inferior.
Jack, what about that rise and fall, perhaps, of Irish-American association nostalgia sentiment?
I think you were right, Tom. I think it did peak in the 20th century. That's just a fact of the immigration, you know. I read that there are 35 million Americans of Irish-American ancestry and barely 200,000 Irish-born among them. So the representatives of the old sod are fading out. And there's a wonderful line in an anthropologist named, I forget his name, Zanicki, I think. Mm-hmm. He writes, "America is the euthanasia of memories." And it happens. And we just heard it from Mark, how, you know, they fade out. And in the 20th century, it was the big, it was the urban political boss. It was the Democratic Party. It was Al Smith. And, of course, triumphantly, John F. Kennedy. That was the great moment in Irish America. But in the future, I mean, I think that euthanasia of memories is just going to continue.
What about it, Alice? How long do those fingerprints last? You thought about this as a novelist. I mean, will they keep showing up in Irish American literature for, you know, another 50 years, another 100 years? Are they there forever? That the old sod, or wherever you've come from to this country?
Yeah, well, I think it endures in more subtle ways. Even if the memories have been fictionalized or completely disposed of, I think it endures in subtle ways. I have discovered in my career an affinity that I have to Irish writers who I had no love for as I was coming up. I was much more enamored with the Russian writers at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And yet I discovered that the way I shape a sentence, the way I shape a story, my propensity, perhaps, for leaving things unsaid without any self-consciousness about where this was coming from on my own part, just in my effort to shape a novel, I discover that I'm very much more Irish than I ever knew, that there is something in the DNA, maybe it's buried in the experience, that is coming through, not just because the details of my stories tend to focus on Irish-American characters, but it's the way the very story is composed that I think probably connects me to the heritage of Irish writers much more than I'd ever intended it to.
And your children and maybe their children one day, what do you anticipate? Does that travel on, whether it's Irish-American or Korean-American? Is it perpetually somehow in the way we frame the world?
Well, I have a younger son who just turned 21 yesterday, named Patrick, of course, who at a very young age discovered Irish music. Not that I ever listened to it, nor did my parents. It was all that old Kamalia stuff that they didn't want any part of and I wasn't interested in. And yet he heard it. He heard it through punk rock groups like Flogging Molly and Secret of Roan Inish movies, and it spoke to him. And he has become more Irish than the Irish, as my parents would have said, drawn to the music and through the music to the history and drawn to a tradition that I never knew.
Wow. So
I think those things do happen over generations. Younger generations approach the world of their ancestors in an entirely different way.
Lisa in Norwich, Vermont. Lisa, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks so much. This is such a great show. My mother was born in County Leitrim, and she's turning 90 next month. And this conversation is like coming home. I feel you guys are describing everything that I feel every day and what goes on in my head, because I grew up with my mother having come here at age 10 from Ireland. I grew up with an Irish immigrant mother, and I had no idea the effect of that on me until I turned about 30, you know, and well, until she and I went back to Ireland, really. We went together, and I got to see where she grew up, the farm, the very farm she grew up in, and all the houses for the animals were still standing, made of stone, but the house for the family was long gone because it was made of mud. And I got an insight into my mother that I never had until I went there and saw, oh, all the things I grew up with my mother, all that fatalism and yet the gleam of joy in her eye and the hope for the future, that isn't because my mother is weird or something. That's because it's how the Irish people are. and it really, until I started my business, I didn't realize the self-doubt part that comes with being Irish and growing up with an Irish parent. Is it, you know, I've started this crazy business here in Vermont, and it's something that my mother always hated, and yes, I'm making a business of it, and who's my biggest supporter? My mother. You know, she has that little glint in her eye for me every day, and she's my biggest, you know, the biggest one to cheer me on.
Lisa, you've given us a lot more to work on here, and I appreciate your call so much. Thank you for calling in from Norwich. Alice McDermott, please stand by in Washington. Jack Beattie, it's so great to have you today. We're talking about Irish America. Here's Yeats, put to music by the Waterboys, the Lake Isle of Innisfree. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I will arise and go now for always night and day. When I stand on the roadside or on a pavement gray, I hear lake water lapping, low sounds of the shore. I hear it in the deep heart's core.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Irish America, the immigrant experience and beyond, with acclaimed novelist Alice McDermott, author of Charming Billy, Someone, and many more, professor of humanities at Johns Hopkins University. She joins us today from Washington, D.C., winner of the National Book Award and many, many accolades. The wonderful Jack Beattie is here as well, author and, of course, our own On Point news analyst and very much Irish-American, Boston native through and through. Let me get to Bobby in Cookeville, Tennessee. Bobby, you've waited patiently. Thanks. You're on the air.
I had a couldn't get bra to you now, Tommy.
Well, thank you, Bobby. What do you know?
No, actually, I'm a New York Puerto Rican. You know, born in New York.
Yeah.
No Irish in me at all. Have two sisters.
But you've got to air and go bra down flat, down pat, Bobby. How? Why?
Sure, and another thing, you are listening to Sid Caesar. You know, when I lived in New York City, I could do impersonations of all the Jewish, Irish, you know, you name it. But, you know, I'm in my late 70s, I remember operating where you used to have an elevator operator, you know, so
sure.
I remember doing that, and I'd like to joke around, and I'd say, you know, fifth floor, Ed and Go bras, Freudian slips.
So you grew up in New York, Bobby. Did you grow up Puerto Rican in Irish territory? What?
Yeah, I went to Power Memorial High School, and that's down off of Columbus Square. There, it's an Irish, it's a Catholic school. So I went to Catholic schools, Catholic boarding schools, and everything. And I had Irish Christian brothers. And I'm a musician. I'd be in the high school band, and even grammar school band. And on St. Patty's Day, I'd be walking down Fifth Avenue with the line painted green. You know,
so Bobby, you're a great you're a great observer for us. Then, what do you take away as a Puerto Rican American, and you grew up with the Irish Americans? What did you take away from that?
Well, I remember this. What this Irish priest telling us one day, he was saying, you know, when my mother came over from Ireland, and she came to Ellis Island, you know, and we were taking her home, and she was saying to us, and you should have seen all the foreigners. She wasn't foreign. You know, Ireland, that's like this Irish state. That's the 51st state over there. So, I mean, that was the attitude. And I used to love to, ensconce myself in the various idiosyncrasies of all of, you know, Irishdom and Jewishdom and Turkishdom. I mean, it was great fun in New York. I miss it. I'm down here in Tennessee, but still in all, right now I'm wearing a Kelly Green shirt, and I've got a plaid tie on with
Bubby, you are terrific. You're terrific. Jack Beatty, I swear I can hear the Catholic school Irish years in Bobby at 70.
just wonderful antic. I mean, and how he's sort of, you know, taken the ethnic smorgasbord and just run the whole thing.
Yeah.
And which, of course, you can do in New York. My gosh, there's God's plenty right there.
Alice, there's Puerto Rico speaking, but with Irish America woven right in.
Well, it is St. Patrick's Day. We're all Irish on St. Patrick's Day.
Bobby, thank you so much. We've got you the picture well in mind, right down to the plaid tie. Steve in Akron, Ohio. Steve, thank you for calling, but you're on the air.
Well, thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make a point. I'm first generation that came to the U.S. in 62. I'm 60 now.
Okay.
And I consider myself an American, but like
of course.
I'm German by heritage.
Yes.
And growing up in the U.S., I grew up with a lot of other basically immigrant cultures, including the Irish and Italians and people from basically mid or central Europe, if you will.
Yeah.
And one thing I did notice is that for the most part, all immigrants for the most part are the same, because I think the same thing brought them here, the same thing drove them here. They are different in that what they bring with them is that they behave differently. So I have noticed that the Italians are much more touchy-feely, as I think the Irish are to some extent. The Spanish certainly are, not the Spanish, but yeah, I mean the Spanish are. So I think fundamentally all of the immigrants are pretty much the same.
Give them long enough in America. I mean, we're all human. There's definitely that. I appreciate your call, Steve. You know, Alice, here's a question for you. One of our listeners is writing online, thanks you for joining us today, and says, I believe one of the most influential aspects of the Irish is their says this listener, use of language, particularly satire, to explain human nature. And I hear that and I understand it, but how do you square it with your comment, which you've made many times, Alice, on the unsaid, the use of language, and maybe satirical language sometimes to light up human nature, but then the unsaid alongside it. How do those live together in Irish-American culture?
Well, I think the unsaid, again, sort of strikes to the heart of our belief in the unseen, that there is value in what we can't see. It goes back to our pagan roots, and as I said, it's taken full advantage of the role of the Catholic Church in Ireland, but that there is something beyond this mortal core, and in some ways something beyond but also concurrent with our ordinary lives, our daily lives. And I think that's what's reflected in the language up to a certain point. And I think it's a distrust of language, too, as good as we are with turning a phrase and creating a satire or a zinger. There's also a sense that language can't get at the most important things. Once it's said, don't trust it too much. And so I think that idea of what exists outside what we can speak of and yet is very much there, what exists outside of what we can see and yet is very much there, all goes to shape the way we look at the world.
Jack, I'd love to hear you on that as well, the unsaid and the silences alongside the loquacious and the garrulous.
Yeah. Well, of course, the famous unsaid is sex. I mean, right? It's not talked about. Doesn't exist.
We can't hear you, Jack.
Right. I have nothing to say about that.
it just didn't, how we came here and all that, but it's not for the likes of you to think about that. And, you know, when you think about it, this is explained by historians who say, well, you had these poor people, you had the oldest son inherited the land. There was very little land to go around. And the other sons, well, they had no way of, they either left or they hung around as laborers, but there was nothing for them to do. And the last thing they could do would be get married. So naturally, there was a kind of prohibition on sex.
Alice, we want to hear you read from your work just a little bit. And maybe on this St. Patrick's Day in particular, given the controversy around gay marchers in the parades in New York and in Boston, there's a passage from someone, wonderful, your latest, just out last fall, where Marie is thinking about her brother, her grown brother, very smart guy, who has abandoned the priesthood in his adulthood. And she realizes as she's thinking about pondering him that she has questions about his sexuality. Would you be kind enough to read for us, Alice?
Yes, certainly. My brother had been the golden child, reciting poetry I couldn't understand. The thin seminarian emerging from the shadow of the tall trees, his prayer book cupped in his hands. Not a year in his first parish, he had given my father the last sacrament, even as the poor man's suffering was at its last and terrible height. I had been startled by the ferociousness of his grief. You slept? When I woke up in the car we had hired from Fagan's funeral parlor. I had been at various times annoyed and puzzled by his solitude and his brooding, his vigilance, the way he feared what was ugly or unkind, and the way compassion seemed to upend him, walking out, naked and weeping, into the ravaged streets where we had been young. My brother was a mystery to me, but a mystery I had always associated with the sacred darkness of the bedroom we had shared in Brooklyn, or the hushed groves of the seminary, or the spice of the incense in the cavernous church. Even with his lifelong silent communion with the words he found in his books, incomprehensible, yes, but in the same way that much that was holy was incomprehensible to me, little pagan. And now my heart fell to think that the holy mystery of who my brother was, might be made flesh, ordinary flesh, by the notion that he was simply a certain kind of man.
Alice McDermott reading there from her wonderful novel, Someone, just out last fall, and I can't recommend it enough. Alice, you've spoken several times about Irish-American authenticity or the push against inauthenticity. And yet here we are on this issue of sexuality that's been controversial in Boston, New York, and just in this weekend, and apparent incapacity or unwillingness to speak to this one. Is it because there's sex involved? Is that what makes homosexuality difficult in some quarters of this culture?
Certainly, yeah. But I think there's also, and this is probably speaking more for my character than the general population,
yeah. Okay.
There's also the reluctance to define any one of us by a single thing, whether it be alcoholism or sexuality or any of the broad definitions we like to give people, to push back against that and to say, yes, but still he is unlike anyone else. He is unique. We will not see his like again. And so to accept one definition, if you know this one thing about this guy, that he's gay, that he's alcoholic, that he's a good father or a bad father, that will never be enough to define him entirely. And I think that's where some of the pushback is, outside the political, outside of the contemporary, but just that reluctance to say any one of us should be defined by one thing, that we are too complex, that there's too much we'll never know about one another, and we need to have the dignity of a full breadth of lives and possibilities in any individual.
Jack Beatty, there's ground truth in that, mm-hmm. and no one falls into one category, and yet that's also a very generous interpretation of what can also simply be homophobia.
Yes, isn't that interesting? Well, you know, it's that idea, you can never say the last word about any human heart. And you can, it's easy to sort of pass by the surface cultural, political moil and talk about these essences. But I think these attitudes are continuous from old Ireland to today, the Puritan strain in Irish Catholicism, it's haunted the thing right from the start. And when you look at the difference in Italy, my gosh, what a different experience. You look at France. Puritanism, I mean, when they came here to New England, the Irish didn't feel all that strange. You know, they resonated with
It was here waiting for them.
Right.
The Puritans got here first.
Right. You call it Calvinism. I call it the church. I mean, it is so defining, the squeamishness about the act.
Jack, you've got a little Beckett for us. Does it would it rest easy right here, Samuel Beckett?
It might well. There's the point that Alice made, that death is always there, unbidden. This is from Pozzo, Blind Pozzo's last words before he leaves the stage in Act Two.
This is in Samuel Beckett, of course, the great Irish.
Waiting for Godot.
Waiting for Godot. Mm-hmm.
Yes, he says, "Have you not done tormenting me with your accursed time? It's abominable. When?" One day, is that not enough for you? One day he went dumb. One day he went blind. One day we'll go deaf. One day we were born. One day we shall die. The same day, the same second. Is that not enough for you? They give birth astride of a grave. The light gleams an instant. Then it's night once more.
Samuel Beckett. But why, Alice, would any culture be more keenly attuned to mortality than another? I mean, that is the common end.
Yes, I was just listening to Jack, thinking of the great line from Yeats, "Under every dancer, a dead man in his grave." The fact that these two things exist together, our awareness of our mortality and yet our ability to be joyous in spite of it. A part of it probably goes back to our roots as an island country, that we lived in close proximity to each other back in the old country. That can be said of many cultures, I understand. But when you're living close to life and death, and the bodies are being waked in the same place where the births are being celebrated, yeah, there's an awareness of that. And when you're going to church on Sunday and being reminded of it in the ritual of the Mass, celebrating the death of Christ time after time, morning after morning, it's going to sink in.
Jack, you've got a little, maybe Bernard Shaw or John Sullivan, something to go out on here?
Actually, I've got something better than that. A little contrary line from Yeats. Oh, the good are always the merry, saved by an evil chance. And the merry love the fiddle, and the merry love to dance.
And under that dancer, Alice reminds us of the other side. You two are so great to be with us on this St. Patrick's Day. What a tremendous treat. Alice McDermott, author of Charming Billy, Someone, if you haven't read it, out last fall, and just a wonderful, wonderful novel. Alice, thank you so much for spending a little St. Patrick's Day time with us today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tom, and thank you, Jack.
Thank you.
Yes, and Jack, glad all you beaties came over. Great job. Thank you so much, Jack.
Thank you.
Here's a little bit of Dropkick Murphys to go out on, Heroes from Our Past. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. They left behind the lives that they once led. And by virtue of their fortitude and single-minded strength, they cleared the way for the people.